We begin a new study this morning, the life of Joseph. We're going to move into the Old Testament and spend some weeks, perhaps even months there. And so we're going to begin right where the story begins, if you'll take your Bible and open to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37, we get there at least the beginning of the details of the life of this man we know as Joseph. Verse 1 of chapter 37 of Genesis says, "Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father." Joseph is 17. And so the teenagers here this morning should be alerted that Joseph's life will speak to your life directly and impactfully. But any teenager here this morning would be quick to tell us that nobody's life begins at 17. We might just be waking up to life at 17, but it doesn't begin there. And Joseph's life doesn't begin when he is 17 either. Though this is the beginning of the narrative of his life, the details that God found to be most important for us to recall as an example to us, his life has its beginning where your life had its beginning, and that was with his parents, right? Sure, that's where our life began. Today is Christie's and my 25th wedding anniversary. I just learned that yesterday. Now, before you're too hard on me, it's not that I had forgotten my anniversary. No man would ever do that, right, men? I had remembered, and I knew it was significant. I knew that 25 years was a silver anniversary, and so I made plans, careful plans, so that I would be with my wife on our anniversary, and we would have dinner together, and I made plans to actually take my wife to San Francisco for a couple of days, and tomorrow evening we would have that dinner together. But one of my children asked some days ago, one of my daughters, "Why don't we go out to eat on Sunday, Dad, in Nashville?" And I said, "Why would we want to do that? I'm leaving Monday morning." "Well," she said, "to celebrate your anniversary. We want to celebrate your anniversary with you." Well, I thought that was not appropriate in a variety of ways. Not the least of which was, I said, "Sunday is not my anniversary. Monday is my anniversary, and I will be in San Francisco." But she said, "Still, we want to celebrate with you because if you guys hadn't got married," she said, "I wouldn't be me." Now, one of my other children heard that and quickly put on her theological hat and said, "No, man's responsibility comes into the divine plan of God. And that's certainly true, but God is sovereign." And so she said to her sister, "If mom and dad hadn't been married, God would have still sovereignly given you to someone else." But the first daughter would not be dissuaded, and she insisted that even if that were to happen, I still would not be me. I'd be a different me from different parents. Pretty profound stuff in the Wilson household, huh? Well, sort of, maybe. But back to the point. They wanted to celebrate our anniversary with us today, on Sunday. And it was yesterday that my daughter said, "Oh, by the way, Dad, your anniversary isn't Monday. It's Sunday." So anyway, I was close. This isn't the first year this has been a problem for me, because I thought it was smart to get married on Thanksgiving Day. That's when we were married. Thanksgiving Day 25 years ago, little did it dawn on me, that date changes every year. So I can only ever really get close. Well, anecdotal time is over. But there was a point to all this. Joseph, like my own children, wouldn't be Joseph. He wouldn't be the Joseph we know without his parents. So we're going to back up this morning at the beginning to a marriage. Unlike most of ours, I think, and see how Joseph's story begins with his parents. And there's a nod to his grandparents even because, as I said, nobody's life begins at 17. So if you would, turn with me to Genesis 27. Go left in your Bible if you were already there in chapter 37. It's in Genesis 27 that we run into Isaac and Rebekah. They are Joseph's grandparents. And Isaac and Rebekah had a son named Jacob. Jacob was Joseph's father. Now Jacob, as you probably know, lived his life with a measure of fear. He was afraid of his twin brother Esau. And perhaps for good reason. You'll remember Esau was the firstborn of the two twins and the rightful heir, as would be typified in a Jewish home. But Jacob had deceived their father Isaac with a little soup and some hairy clothes, and in that he had gained the blessing that belonged to Esau. Now you can read about that in the very first verses of chapter 27 and be reminded that that is the ultimate picture of God's sovereignty in all of the Bible. It is the illustration that Paul would use when he wrote the book of Romans to try in some way to explain the riches and the depth and the certainty of God's sovereignty to us. This is Romans chapter 9 and verse 10. I printed it for you to follow along. He's talking about this event. And he says, "And not only this, but there was Rebekah also when she had conceived twins by one man, our father Isaac. For though the twins were not yet born and had not done anything good or bad, so that God's purpose according to his choice would stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls. And so it was said to her, the older will serve the younger. But more than that," Paul says, "it was written, Jacob I loved, but Esau, I hated." And so Jacob lived in fear. He lived in fear of his brother. And that's in view in Genesis 27 in verse 41. If you'll look there and follow along, we'll begin reading this account. It says, "Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." Now, when the words of her elder son Esau were reported to Rebekah, she sent and called her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Behold, your brother Esau is consoling himself concerning you by planning to kill you. Now, therefore, my son, obey my voice and arise, flee to Haran, to my brother Laban. Stay with him a few days until your brother's fury subsides. Until your brother's anger against you subsides and he forgets what you did to him. Then I'll send and I'll get you from there. Why should I be bereaved," she says to Jacob, "of both of you in one day?" What was Rebekah thinking? Well, she was thinking that these two brothers had the potential to literally kill each other. And she was concerned most for her son's life, Jacob. And so she talks to her husband, Isaac. And then she gives us, in our understanding, another reason why he should be sent away. You can see it in the next verse, verse 46. "Rebekah then said to Isaac, I'm tired of living because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth, like these, from the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? I'm afraid," she's thinking, "that Jacob might be killed by Esau, or that they might kill each other. And that's bad. But worse," she seems to say, "if Jacob lives here and then marries one of these women, the daughters of the land of Canaan, a Canaanite, what good would my life be to me then?" Now, I think there's a subtle lesson there, men. Listen to me, your mother can tell you it is better to die than to marry the wrong woman. That's a part of what seems to be on Rebekah's mind. I would be better off if you were dead than to stay here and have him marry one of those women. Now the reality is Rebekah didn't want Jacob to marry a pagan, a Canaanite. And they're living there in pagan land. She doesn't seem to care who Esau marries, and in fact, you would learn if you read on to chapter 28 that Esau, as a means of kind of jabbing mom and dad both, intentionally marries a Canaanite. But this is a picture of Rebekah's favoritism that she had toward Jacob. And so we go to the next verse, which is now chapter 28. Look at verse 1. So Isaac called Jacob, and he blessed him, and he charged him, and he said to him, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and from there take to yourself a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. May he also give you the blessing of Abraham to you and to your descendants with you, that you may possess the land of your sojournings, which God gave to Abraham." And then Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Paddan Aram, to Laban, son of Bethuel the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. Now here in that little encounter with his father Isaac, Jacob receives a blessing. And it's not just any blessing he receives. There's first the ordinary blessing of a father, but he says, no, there's another blessing I want you to have, I want you to realize, and that's the blessing of Abraham. I want you to understand you're the son of promise. And this blessing is an incredible thing, more than Jacob could possibly comprehend. But it would be his to carry. It would be his to benefit from. Now, it's a good thing to get a blessing from your father, but it's another thing entirely if that blessing were to be affirmed by God. And that's exactly what happens to Jacob. On his way to Haran, he stops to rest and he has an encounter with God. We know that, most of us from our childhood, as the picture of Jacob's ladder. You could see it in chapter 28, verse 10. Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran. He came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place. He had a dream. And behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac." God here is speaking to Jacob in a dream. And the message is a direct confirmation of the blessing he had already gotten from his father Isaac. It's a picture of the promise. Look at what he said in the latter part of verse 13. God speaking, "The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." So here's Jacob on a journey to find a wife. And in this little adventure, he finds there's way more significance than he ever thought possible. Something way bigger than him finding a wife is happening here. And there's a lesson that we could learn here. One that we should all take special note of and listen, especially if you're a single here this morning. You are, like Jacob, perhaps on a journey to find a spouse. And you should mark this down. I printed it for you in so many words. While looking for a spouse, it is far more important and a necessary prerequisite for success in finding a spouse that you first find God's promise for your life. Or I could say it another way, to realize that God is present here and now, right where you are, as a single man or a single woman. That's what Jacob learned. Look at his reaction in verse 16. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it." He was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." Now listen, Christian single. You have to arrive there first. Surely the Lord is in this place. Right now where I'm at. And many of you are like Jacob and would say with Jacob, he's right here, right now, and I didn't know it. You see, God didn't show up in the dream. That's not what Jacob realized. What Jacob realized, he was there already. He was there all along. It was just this reality of God's presence that now dawned on him. And so he said, surely the Lord is in this place, in this season of my life, right now, while I'm single. And I didn't know it. But having known it, look what he said. How awesome is this place? Christian young men and women, unless you realize God is present where you are now, and that this is an awesome season of life, you aren't really appealing to someone else who's looking for a spouse. They don't want to be your satisfaction. They want to marry someone satisfied. That's the way to begin, and that's what Jacob learned. And I know it's frustrating. I do, young men and women. I have four unmarried children. Three of those are daughters, all of what we might say are marrying age. And they express their own frustrations. How do we find a spouse? And then it becomes frustration with their current situation. So listen again, ladies, and listen again, men. Learn this now on the way. God's there. God's right where you are right now. And say with Jacob, I didn't know it, but having known it, it's awesome. And it's the very doorway to heaven. Right now where you are. Some of you are equally frustrated as a married couple, and you need to be reminded of that as well, right? He's right there, and he's been there all along. He didn't leave you. Use these days to realize that. Use this opportunity to relish in his presence and to worship him. That's how a single becomes fit for marriage. Use these days to increase your trust in him so that you marry in faith, not to find faith. It's his promise that you want, young ladies, not some man of your dreams. It's his dream, young men, that you want, not some woman of your dreams. So settle there. Don't shortchange this time of your life. Look at verse 18. Jacob got up early in the morning, and he took the stone that he had put under his head, and he set it up as a pillar, and he poured oil on its top, and he called the name of that place Bethel. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. You know what Bethel means? The house of God. The presence of God. Jacob worships God there. He doesn't imagine that one day if something else happens, I'll worship God. He hesitates. And he worships. It's not a place where God might come. It's a place where he was already. Now, we have to mark this too. As significant as this event was, it was not significant enough to change Jacob's nature. He was, a difficult man in very many ways. He was a devious man. He was a deceiver. His very name means deceiver. This was the mark of his life. And from the midst of this incredible experience of the presence of God, I want you to see what this deceiver does. He begins to speak suddenly very Jacob-like words in verse 20. Then Jacob made a vow. Not a good idea. Jacob, not satisfied with God's promise, decides he'll make a promise. So he made a vow. And here's what he said. If God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take, and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. This stone, which I've set up as a pillar, will be God's house. And of all that you give me, God, I will surely give a tenth to you. So now Jacob suddenly, just in the same instant, wants to negotiate with God. He wants to make out this little bargain with God, and that will mark his life, has already marked his life, will continue to mark his life. He is forever making bargains with somebody. Now here's the deal. God, if you'll be with me, if you will keep me, if you will feed me, if you will clothe me, if you will bring me back safely, and implicit in that, of course, if you'll give me the wife, which is the whole purpose of this journey, then, God, as a token of my appreciation, you get to be my God. That's exactly what he said. And that's so much like us, isn't it? I think we laugh at Jacob because we see Steve and we see Tony and we see Richard and we see, you know, Jane and Sally and so many other Christians. We see us. God, if you will, then I will. If you will, then you get to be my God. Woo! How lucky are you, God? Look at the end of that. Look what he says. This stone, this mark of your presence. If you will give me everything I want, I'll give a tenth back to you. Now understand something here. We have to keep our chronology in focus here. This is long before the establishing of a nation Israel under the law of Moses. This is long before the tithe was introduced as at least a three-time-a-year response to God's provision that would accumulate up to about 33.5% of the people's, not income for the year, but of all their possessions that was given back to God, to the temple, to the nation Israel. This was long before that. This was long before the tithe was there to support the social structure of the nation of Israel and pay for all the festivals and the celebrations. This was long before the tithe was there to support the political and the military structure of the nation of Israel, and long before the tithe was implemented even as a celebration of worship and the religious affairs of the nation. This was way before that. This isn't that. This is a reaction that Jacob hopes God will affirm. And it goes like this. I'll make a deal with you, God. You give me everything I want, I'll give you 10% back. How's that sound? He's conniving. And even in his commitment to give a tenth, it was maybe. Maybe. If you do your part, maybe I'll give a little back. But you see, what I give back will all depend on what you give me first. And upon whether or not it measures up to my expectations. So you see, even though there's a significant event in the life of Jacob here, where he does actually acknowledge the presence of God in his current state, he is a very, very, very slow learner. And it hasn't changed him much. So off he goes. Now watch. Romance awaits. Verse 1 of chapter 29. Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the sons of the east. He looked and saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it. For from that well they watered the flocks. Now the stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, they would then roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep, and then put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. So Jacob arrives and he says to them, verse 4, "My brothers, where are you from?" And they said, "We are from Haran." He said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "We know him." And he said to them, "Is it well with him?" And they said, "It is well." Now watch. And there is Rachel, his daughter, coming with the sheep. He said, "Behold, it is still high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered. Water the sheep and go, pasture them." But they said, "We cannot until all the flocks are gathered." And they roll the stone from the mouth of the well. "Then we water the sheep." While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the mouth of the well and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Now, do you know what this is? This is love at first sight. That's what we just read. Jacob sees Rachel coming, and he immediately goes into action. Notice again, verse 6. We know Laban, and he is well, and off there in the distance is his daughter Rachel. Then Jacob says, hey, why don't you guys get out of here? Won't you guys go ahead, get the sheep watered, clear out. It's not time to be hanging out by the well. Get back out in the field. You know, like, disappear. He saw her, and immediately, apparently, he's in love. And he's only seen her from a distance. And we all say, how romantic is that? And it is. It's perhaps the most romantic encounter we're given in all of the Bible that is actually illustrated through these real events. And I don't want to strip it of its romance. That's why I titled the sermon, Love at First Sight. But I think we also have to see that Jacob has something more in mind than just love. But hold on to that. We'll get back to that. Here she comes in all her beauty. Can you see it? Not really. It's hard to picture a beautiful shepherdess. It's hard to picture a shepherdess. It's even hard for us to picture a shepherd. But stretch your mind a little there. And here she comes. And he acts to get rid of those other men. And apparently they didn't move. So he moves. He goes and rolls away that stone over the well. Now, there's indication that they all gather one at a time and wait till they all get there to roll the stone away, because this is a significant stone to roll away. And it's best rolled away when there's at least four people to help roll it away. So they wait for at least four flocks to gather, then they roll away the stone. Jacob is pumped up, though, and he doesn't need any help. He just goes and rolls the stone away. And he's looking over at Rachel. So if they won't leave, at least he can, you know, create some kind of a diversion that will allow him to meet her. And so there he is without any sheep of his own, suddenly taking an interest in her sheep. Isn't that nice? That's really sweet, really. And you can kind of see that, can't you? Awkward as we are as men. You know, what do you say at a time like this? And so he doesn't really have anything to say. So he does something else. Verse 11. Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept. Jacob told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. Now, if you get a sense that this is all happening pretty fast, dads, if you're a little uncomfortable right now, I'm with you. It's moving a little quick, isn't it? But that's exactly the sense that you have to get, because that's exactly what's happening here. Everybody's in a hurry, it seems. The inspired writer points out something, however, that on first sight, Jacob saw love, but not just for Rachel. He also saw love for what she had. I think it's clear. Look again at verse 6. They said, it's well with Laban, and there's Rachel coming with the sheep. And then in verse 9, while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep. And then again in verse 10, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, ought to be a period there, but there's not, because he also saw the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. Here's this beautiful woman, and she's got money. She's rich. Her daddy's got all these sheep. I mean, it couldn't be going any better for Jacob. And God gets what? 1 out of 10. That's the plan. I get all the rest if I work this just right. These sheep will be my sheep. 9 out of 10. And if you know anything about Jacob's story, you know that that will play out in so many, many ways. But we're not studying Jacob. So we have to hurry. He meets Laban, and he works for Laban for a month. And then he meets Laban's other daughter. And you'll see that in verse 16 of chapter 29. Now, Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. And Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face. Now Jacob loved Rachel. So he said, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter Rachel. Laban said, it's better that I give her to you than to give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him to be but a few days because of his love for her. Rachel, this beautiful woman. Do you see what the Bible said? Beautiful of form and face. She is beautiful in very beautiful ways. The Bible wants us to see that. I know it's common to say beauty's in the eyes of the beholder, and there's truth in that, but it's also true, biblically true, that there is such a thing as real, tangible beauty. And she has it. Now, that includes some things, I'm sure, that we don't think of when we think of beauty, and it probably doesn't include some things that we usually think of when we think of beauty, but it is no less true, biblically true, that she was beautiful in form and face. Not just a pretty face, right? No, she was more than a pretty face. And she's contrasted with her sister, who apparently wasn't so beautiful. And we're told to notice what it says, that her eyes were weak. Now, that's an interesting phrase in the Hebrew and hard to translate. Some like to take a little generosity with their translation and say she was weak to look at. That's what that actually means. I don't think that's what it means, but it might have some truth in it. What I do know that the Bible does tell us is that she was marked not for her beauty, but for what she lacked. She didn't see well. So Jacob asked Laban for his daughter's hand, the hand of the beautiful Rachel. And so Laban says what? Sure, why not? This guy's an easy guy to negotiate with. Jacob should have had his antennae up right away. It shouldn't be that easy. You're as good as any other man. Why not? But look at the romance again in verse 20. Jacob served 7 years, and they seem like only a few days. Why? The Bible tells you why. Because he was in love with Rachel. Now, men, listen to me for a minute. Note that, single men, marriage is costly. And some of you aren't married because you're not willing to pay the cost. You're not willing to do the work that's a prerequisite to being fit for marriage. Some of you need to wake up and realize that your achievement points on the Xbox don't fit you for marriage. No, you need to get out and work. And you need to be committed. And you need to be dedicated. You need to have a goal. And you need to work hard for that goal. That's what fits you as a young man to be married. And by the way, that extends today, sadly, beyond those that aren't married to some of those that are married. And they think achievement points works out good in a marriage too. And that's just silly. It says something of the character of young men today, the hours they spend on televisions and with their friends instead of the hours they spend with their wife. And listen to me carefully, it says something of the character of their wives as well because they put up with it. Time and time again in the Bible, men are reminded that it is necessary to work hard to build a family, to work hard to support that family. Not to work hard so you can play hard, but to work hard so you can be there. Invest the time and the energy and the dedication needed to raise a family. You need to have a goal in view, men, and then that goal needs to be under attack, and then you need to say, I got it. And then you need to say, I got a new goal. And that goal needs to be under attack, and you need to say, I got it. That's Christian living. That's Christian living to the glory of God. It may not be American living, and it may not be what you see on television, but it is still Christian, godly living. To press on, to accomplish, to be committed, to work hard. Not just some passive existence that relies on others for your provision and your security. It's pitiful. It's a pitiful way to live, and it's pitiful to watch. And more than that, your arrogance sets yourself aside from any good counsel. You'll ask for it when it's presented to you, and then you won't listen to any of it. I'm not talking to all of you, and I may not even be talking to some of you. But I am definitely talking into this culture, in this country, in this day. Now, that hard work and effort doesn't always work out the way you expect. You need to understand that, right? You don't do it so that. You do it because that's what God says. And it doesn't work out good for Jacob either, by the way. Let's get back to our story where the deceiver now gets deceived. Verse 21, then Jacob said to Laban at the end of the 7 years, give me my wife, for my time is completed, that I may go into her. And Laban gathered all the men of the place, and he made a feast. And now in the evening, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and Jacob went into her. Laban also gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. Look at verse 25, underlined it. So it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. Now, I won't even try to explain that. How's that possible? Maybe I will try to explain it with a little bit of sensitivity. Look back at verse 21. Give me my wife. Why? So we can begin our life together? My life now lost in her life and hers in mine? No. Give me my wife. Why? So I can go into her. It seems that Jacob, at the end of these 7 years, has little on his mind other than the consummation of the marriage. So much so that he doesn't even realize, listen, so much was he consumed by that he didn't even realize who he was sleeping with. Can you imagine that? Oh, yeah. I can. I've seen young men speak of their wives and their marriage in just these terms. Oh, marriage is great. Somebody to cook for you, somebody to clean up your mess, and somebody to satisfy all your sexual demands. Listen, men, you'll wake up one day and you're in for a surprise. Sexual intimacy is a blessed and sacred part of marriage. But it is by no means the center of marriage, and it is certainly no place for your unbridled appetites. And we'll actually talk more about that later in the life of Joseph. But Jacob wakes up with another woman. And he said to Laban, verse 25, what is this that you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served with you? Why then have you deceived me? But Laban said, it's not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. Firstborn, ding! I think that didn't catch Jacob's ear. Complete the week of this one and we'll give you the other also for the service which you shall serve with me for another 7 years. Now, it's pretty typical that pastors will interact with this story and say he worked 7 years for Leah, and then he worked another 7 years so he could marry Rachel. That's not actually what happened. He did work 7 years, and he did marry Leah. And then all he had to finish was the honeymoon, give her this first week. And then he married Rachel, and then he worked another 7 years to pay for her in arrears. So notice verse 28, Jacob did so and completed her week, and he gave him his daughter Rachel as his wife. And Laban also gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maid. Jacob. Love at first sight. So much in love and yet so misguided in love in so many ways. But now the home is complete. Strange as it was. And love at first sight is now quite a sight. Because you have a quartet of women that will become integral to our understanding of Joseph. There's Leah there, and her lovely maid Zilpah, and Rachel there, and her maid Bilhah. They're a quartet of women that will be more than adequate to expose Jacob's weaknesses. And then into this home, into this bizarre family, Joseph is born. And the story just gets more interesting from there. But that's for next week. Love at first sight. Do you believe it happens? I do. It did here. But also they say that love is blind. Do you believe that? I do. It sure happened here. But under and over and all around it all, in the midst of all the human frailty and sin and deception, there is a love there by the hand of a sovereign God. Do you believe that? You should, because God is doing all of this for His purpose. To redeem for Himself a people. And integral to that will be His plan for one son, the 12th son born to this family, Joseph. Let's pray. What a story, Father. What a way to begin. Fascinating to consider that with Joseph, You have said more to us than of any other man in the book of Genesis that chronicles the earliest patriarchs of the human race. 14 chapters. Like the 14 chapters You dedicate to the life of Abraham, but 25% more words. Linger there, You say. Study that man. Learn from him. Help us, Father, to learn these lessons. To see Joseph as an example of faith that triumphs. Teach us in these weeks ahead. Grow us up. And remind us again and again and again, which Joseph's life just does in the mere reading of it, that You are there. Right there. Whether it's the pit or the palace. You're there, and You're sovereign, and all of this is meant for our good. These things we ask, expecting You to teach us, for Christ's sake. Amen.
You've been listening to Pastor and Bible Teacher Steve Wilson of Grace Community Church in Bowling Green, Kentucky. We trust you've been encouraged and challenged by this message. If you would like to listen to more of Pastor Wilson's messages or obtain more information on the ministry of Grace Community Church, you can go to our website at www.gccbg.com. That's gccbg.com. Or call 270-781-2595.